So in learning objective number 6, I didn't catch the whole phrase. You said oxidation of a primary alcohol gives...
Yeah, do you still have your organic chemistry notes or book?
No, I don't.
Because you should be reviewing that by this point.
Okay, well, maybe you can help me.
It's one of the main rules in organic chemistry, primary alcohol. And before we even use that term, does that mean something?
Oh, it gives a...
Like the methyl groups?
Withdrawal? No.
Well, what I was asking just now was, do you know what a primary alcohol is?
I think it just has one O.
Alcohol, just one O group attached to a yellow carbon.
Which, what is your, I'm sorry, I missed, what was that?
No, I was wrong.
Oh, okay.
So, maybe you should not know what alcohol is. You were kind of answering that. There's anything about H groups. Yeah. H group on a rather ordinary carbon.
Right.
So not a carbon that's doubly bonded to another carbon, or a carbon that's doubly bonded to an oxygen, or anything special like that. It's an ordinary carbon. Like this carbon right here, this is a rather ordinary carbon. It only has other carbons and hydrogens attached to it by a single bond. It's a very ordinary carbon, is what I'm calling it. And then no H group on it.
Would that be a primary?
Would make it an alcohol, and this is a primary alcohol. Next, I'll draw a secondary alcohol and hope that you see the difference. People would pronounce this primary, but they might write it that way, first one degree, first degree. And then a secondary alcohol. I'm gonna need at least 3 carbons to show a secondary alcohol. So that's good enough. They both have just one OH.
I gotcha. They're counting the carbons. I gotcha.
There doesn't need to be methyl groups. I'll change it so you don't see. So what you're doing is you're counting how many other carbons are attached directly to the carbon with the OH group.
Right.
So there's even something called tertiary carbons, where there'd be 3 carbons. That's tertiary.
Oh, I see.
Where there would be 3 carbons attached to the carbon that has an OH group.
How many carbons the carbon that the OH group is attached to is also attached to?
Yes. So this one's a secondary alcohol. And to finish the idea, a tertiary alcohol would be where there's a carbon with an ordinary OH group, and it's a carbon with 3 other carbons attached.
Right.
That would be a tertiary alcohol. So what are you going to do to review organic chemistry, if that's what you need to do at this time when you're learning your biochemistry? There's lots of organic chemistry books in the library. I'm more than willing to talk about organic chemistry in tutorials. We're doing it now. If you no longer have your own notes from organic chemistry, maybe someone else has good notes that they would offer you. What ideas do you have for reviewing your organic chemistry?
Yeah, I think all those are good ideas. And I guess maybe as a quick fix, oxidation of our primary alcohol gives what? No,
well,
that's not what you want to say.
Let's draw it before we ever even name it.
Okay.
Let's not even worry about its name. Just try to draw it.
What's oxidizing?
So if this alcohol is
oxidized. It's an end. No aldehyde's on the end.
I'm going to suggest that it's going to lose both this H. It definitely has to lose that H.
Right.
And then one of these, I'll pick that one, has to lose those two H's.
You can double
so that,
it's going to form a double bond.
Right.
That's what the ketone is.
That's why it's more oxidized.
Right, okay.
It's more oxygen.
I'm with you.
Less hydrogen.
Another way to think of it as being oxidized would be to look at this carbon right here and to see that when that hydrogen leaves, it takes these electrons with it. That carbon is losing electrons.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
So, without even worrying about what it could be called or what family it belongs to, we have determined that the property looked like this. So, you don't have to put in the dots, those are optional. But we have a carbon doubly bonded to oxygen now. I think we get the end of a chain of carbons because we started with a primary alcohol. So now you know what family it belongs to.
Ketone.
Not quite, but close.
It's aldehyde.
It's that one's an aldehyde. Yeah.
If it is another carbon.
Because it has an H on that double base.
The primary alcohol oxidizes to an aldehyde, right?
Yes.
Yes!
But I tried to make it more than memorizing that name.
Cool.
I tried to make it a series of conceptual thoughts.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Cool.
Now, I think you would really benefit from looking at oxidation of the secondary alcohol. One thing that's going to help you with is realizing the difference between an aldehyde and a ketone.
In my next note, review aldehyde and ketone general structures.
Let's just do it on the end or in the middle.
Okay, so where this one would lose hydrogen is... Where this one would lose hydrogen is if it was one from the oxygen and one from the carbon. So I'm circling up, hydrogens, similar to the way I did there.
Yeah. So that's because the electronegative, like the oxygen atom, is pulling, hogging those electrons, making the bond like weaker for the hydrogens?
Making it so that when the hydrogen leaves, the electrons remain behind on the oxygen. Yeah, so like this bond breaking, I would draw the arrow going this way. In fact, I might bring those electrons all the way to here where I show them in the final picture. Because of the electronegativity of the oxygen hogging those electrons and keeping them with it. Yeah. So doing something similar, starting at an alcohol like this, an alcohol where the OH group is somewhere in the interior of the chain rather than at the end of the chain. Then you get something that would have the carbonyl group, it might be called, the carbon-oxygen double bond of an aldehyde or a ketone. That carbon-oxygen group might be called the carbonyl group. Get that carbonyl group at the middle of the chain or within the interior of the chain instead of at the end of the chain. If you look at the carbonyl carbon here versus the carbonyl carbon here, what's different about them is how many carbons they're attached to. Carbonyl carbon here is attached to just one carbon. Carbonyl carbon here is attached to two carbons. We're essentially examining the difference between aldehyde
and a ketone.
And a ketone.
Okay, great.
And once you get so that you can do these forwards, practice doing them backwards. Because in biochemistry, these are often reversible reactions, catalyzed by some kind of dehydrogenase. So you need to be able to talk not only about oxidizing the alcohols, but going the other direction as well, where you reduce the aldehyde, where you reduce the ketone. And it's more often the secondary alcohol-ketone relationship that we run into, more often that one than this one. But we do run into both. It's organic chemistry that you're not allowed to forget because you still need it.
I think it's maybe organic chemistry that I need to learn because I didn't know it the first time.
Tell me about your organic chemistry. Because I am very interested. It's really kind of a hot topic between me and admissions, what kind of organic chemistry people come in with.
Organic chemistry 1 and 2, or...
You took it in the summer?
No, I took it at a regular university. It was all science majors, and it was just really hard.
Okay.
It was like too much. It was
like those were semesters, so it was a full year.
Yeah.
But all that's required is 2 quarters, and I just took 2 quarters of vocab.
And was it a 2-quarter sequence as designed?
Right.
To be 2 quarters?
But Bastier says that it doesn't have to be a 2-quarter sequence. You can just take the first 2 quarters and 3 quarters.
Yeah.
Which is really wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They should
it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
And if they hear it from students, maybe it would
It's a year versus
2 quarters. You're not getting
a year versus 2 thirds.
What?
You don't get the whole series with like 2 quarters, whereas semester you're getting the whole series.
So the first 2 quarters is like the first semester.
Well,
first semester and a half.
It's 2 thirds of a year.
Yeah. And organic chemistry sequences are most important, I think, for introducing biological molecules to you. And they always put that off to the end, it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you only take 2 quarters of a 3-quarter sequence, you never get introduced to biological molecules, and then you find yourself.
They should just make you take a full year, because even though the 2-quarter class that I took,
but you wouldn't believe, you would not believe the trouble I have getting to rewrite that.
Because they tried to get 3 quarters, and we wanted 2 quarters. We just went by everything really fast, and I didn't get anything out of it because it was a 2-quarter sequence.
If it's going to be less than a full year, it needs to be streamlined for people that want to take biochem.
Right.
It needs to get to the biological molecules.
I learned all about this in my like last quarter of organic chemistry.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would have been completely skipped.
I don't remember anything I learned because I had a bad teacher.
I know.
Or I just had a bad perspective on it or something.
I never really did that in class.
I took my class like 3 years ago. And I'm like, kind of remembering, but it's
so long ago.
Yeah.
So I have another question. So if you put another OH group on that, like, say that secondary alcohol, like, on the last carbon. What, is that still, you call that now an alcohol still, or?
It's an alcohol two ways.
Okay.
It's a primary alcohol right over here, and it's a secondary alcohol
and
over here.
So they just say it's a 1-2, or how do you, how do you say that?
I mean, something that's doubly an alcohol, it's an alcohol two places, is a diol.
Diol. Okay.
So glycerol is a triol.
Right, right, okay.
It's an alcohol three places.
Gotcha.
What was your question in regards to learning this or the objective that you...
Oh, I just missed what he said in class, and he said that oxidation of a primary alcohol will give an aldehyde, and secondary will give a ketone. And it was talking in reference to... let me see. I don't know, learning objective 6 somewhere. So. I would know, it says, how does lactate cause fatigue?
It's a combination of lactate and protons, so maybe I would call this lactic acid, that inhibit the enzymes inside of the cell for producing energy.
Oh.
That's one way that you can fatigue a muscle. That's the kind of fatigue you would be experiencing if you did pull-ups until you can't do anymore, or you did push-ups so you can't do anymore. That kind of fatigue is the lactic acid.
Right.
There's another kind of fatigue with muscles involved in an endurance event like a marathon, where your muscle glycogen gets depleted and you hit the wall.
Okay, thanks.
So the enzymes you're talking about are just for breaking down fat or glycogen. Not going to be involved in glycolysis if they can't keep up.
I was thinking of glycolysis.
You were.
Of glycolysis being
and so why would they want to shut them off if they can keep up? Is it a fact that they can't keep up with the energy demands, or why?
Well, she was talking about lactate or lactic
right
acid accumulating in the cell to the point where this would happen. What you could do is just decrease the intensity of your activity. and allow the lactate some time to get out of those cells. Avoid that.
You said that it inhibits enzymes from cells in the
tissue? Yes, and he got even more specific by mentioning the glycolysis. Which, if I was working a muscle really hard, it would be important in that muscle for providing it with enough energy. So the lactic acid can interfere.
Does it also upregulate its conversion or getting out of the cell?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I know.
But you know for sure it downregulates glycolysis.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Inhibits is the term. We're not really talking about decreasing the number of those enzymes, but we're talking about maybe the
same thing. Right, okay.
Changing their shapes. And when you slow down the intensity of your activity, the muscle cell might even be able to work aerobically, where it can use other fuels besides glucose, like fatty acids or ketone bodies. And you don't make lactic acid when you use those. You only make lactic acid when you use glucose. Glucose to pyruvate, and the pyruvate can reduce the lactate.
I missed class on before the on last Thursday.
Before the
anatomy exam, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was just gonna work through on my own the learning objectives for oxidative phosphorylation. But since there's a lot of us here, I'm not sure. But assuming that also missed class, then maybe we could all do it together.
It doesn't matter if we missed class or not. We can do that. That'd be good.
Would you guys like to just, yes, anyone object?
I was there and I would like to go over them.
Starting in number one.
Okay.
Yeah, number
one. There's a general consensus, that would be good.
Great, yeah, we can start wherever. I think our notes from the last day left off through four, but I'm okay with reviewing through, because I think one through four went pretty speedy anyway, right?
Yeah.
So what's the big topic before we dive into learning objective five? What is oxidative?
Electron transfer chain?
That's part of it. That sets up the gradient.
Right.
Use it.
Right. Are you picturing a membrane when you say that?
Yeah.
The gradient is across a membrane. And it's best if you want to get every point on the discussion of this that you mention the membrane.
So oxidative, it's a oxidation of oxygen and make water. And
no, let's straighten that out.
It involves the reduction
of
the last electron.
Okay. That happens at the very end of the electron transport chain. But is that the purpose of oxidative phosphorylation?
No.
To make water?
It doesn't care about water.
I hope that it's not just to make water. ATP, people are mentioning ATP or energy. Right. That's really the purpose. So is this helpful to try and have you put into your own words the topic that we're going to talk about?
Yes.
Oxidative phosphorylation. So this is going to be in your own words. I should check.
So if that's the part of the electron transport chain, the very last part of it, and with the ATP synthase. Is that right?
The oxidative phosphorylation starts with the electron transport chain and ends with what ATP synthase does.
So it's inclusive of all of the electron transport chain?
Yes.
Okay.
And so it's...
And ATP synthase.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's taking all those electrons that the different carriers from the TCA cycle now have through the different redox reactions, right?
The electron transport chain does that. Takes electrons. Yes.
So that creates the gradient for the protons? No, for
that's
the
electrons. Gradient.
That
this
is the gradient.
This is a proton gradient. So as we discuss oxidative phosphorylation, we need to talk about electrons and protons. And right. It's kind of like the electrons are going this way, and the protons are going that way.
Right. Okay.
But electrons are being involved with oxygen.
There's the final acceptor.
And then the protons.
The protons are being moved.
Yeah.
The protons are being moved from the mitochondrial matrix to the intermembrane space, and since that is going across the inner mitochondrial membrane in a direction that would be against a gradient for them, this is pumping the protons and requires an input of energy. So that might become a question in my mind, is where does the electron transport chain get the energy that it needs to pump protons across that membrane?
Two places.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, yeah. I was going to ask a question, so you should answer this one first.
Two places, NADH and FADH2.
Those bring it, the electrons.
Right. You're saying where they get the... Where actual energy. It's from the energy field's electronegativity.
NADH and FAD2H bring electrons to the electron transport chain. But then how the electron transport chain gets energy from them, from those electrons, is by passing them from one carrier to the next, to the next. Those are all redox reactions.
Right.
When the electrons change hands, there's a donor of the electrons and an acceptor of the electrons. That's a redox reaction I just described.
Yeah, but...
And reactions, chemical reactions, can be exergonic, can release energy.
Yeah, they're stepping down in energy each time they do that. And I think it passes to a more electronegative atom each time it does that. And oxygen's on the bottom, and then the two...
Yeah.
I don't remember if it's iron or some other things, electronics, like in the middle. There's iron and one of the proteins, and I don't know what the other one is, sulfur.
We saw irons of two kinds in the chain. We saw heme iron when we got to cytochromes. And before that, we saw non-heme iron and iron sulfur centers.
Iron sulfur.
So as the redox reactions you're talking about, are you talking about the ones in the TCA cycle?
No, I'm talking about the ones in the electron transport chain.
Okay, so... The energy released from those redox reactions, that's the energy that fuels the pump, the proton pump?
Yes.
And why do we want a proton pump?
Because that's going to create or maintain or build a gradient for ATP synthase to use. Because the main purpose of oxidative phosphorylation is to make what?
ATP.
ATP. So try to get to ATP being made and explain how that happened.
So proton pump is the main ATP producer.
Well, it provides the energy.
Which of these things sounds like it produces ATP? Use the main numbers. Would it be the oxidative phosphorylation's electron transport chain that produces ATP, or would it be the ATP synthase part that produces ATP? I tried to make it sound pretty obvious. ATP synthase is the part that makes ATP.
And
so where does it get the energy to do that?
From the gradient
across the membrane.
Right.
It allows that gradient to relax through it, and that gives it the energy it needs to make ATP.
So
you've had your hand up for a long time.
I guess I'm more of a visual learner, so when we talk about it, sometimes it's just up in the air. And specifically in relation to where the energy is coming from in the first place, we initially discussed that.
In most discussions in my class, the energy has been traceable back to, it started off as energy in fuel molecules. Like it was energy in a glucose molecule. And by breaking down the glucose and oxidizing it, this energy eventually becomes energy in ATP molecules. And that's the form it needs to be in for muscle contraction. But But if I was to trace this energy that was in the fuel molecules, and then it belongs to ATP, and then it's used for muscle contraction, and maybe it becomes the energy that I put into this chair. that energy, original spots, if I trace it back as far as I can trace it, it can be sun. That's how it ended up in a glucose molecule, with some plant taking sunlight and making glucose molecules.
Those animals down, so extremophiles down in the water.
No, but you were asking more about the energy, if the redox reactions that are the energy that make the electron transfer chain, right?
Yeah, because we were talking about like NADH and the hydrogens providing like the electrons, but then you asked something about where's the energy come from?
Yes.
So focusing more energy coming out.
Focusing more on the oxidative phosphorylation specifically. Electrons going from one carrier of the electron transport chain to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, all the way until the electrons are finally given oxygen, is making waters. That's a series of exergonic reactions.
Right.
And that means that these reactions release energy. And the components of the electron transport chain, three of them, complexes one, three and four, cross that membrane and know how to use the energy from these redox reactions to move protons across that membrane and add them to a gradient where there's already more protons out here than in here.
And in here is where? In the inner mitochondria?
This is the matrix.
Okay.
That's the innermost
chain
inside of mitochondria. And therefore, this membrane is the membrane that encloses the matrix. This membrane is the inner
mitochondria membrane, right?
The inner mitochondrial membrane. And this space out here would be the space between the inner membrane and the outer membrane. That's the intermembrane space.
Okay.
And then in this same membrane, that's where it really needs to be, actually, in this same membrane is ATP synthase.
Which is an enzyme?
Yes, hence the ASC1. Enzyme names often tell you what reaction they catalyze, if you know how to read their names. So that enzyme's name is trying to tell me that it catalyzes the synthesis of ATP.
So where does the ADP and the P sub I that the synthase is going to use come from?
They're floating around right in here.
They're just floating?
Yeah.
Well, where do they come from?
Well, they're kind of...
ADP and the P sub I might have come from ATPs that got broken. And now we're trying to put them back together.
I guess I'm still confused on the connection between the proton gradient and the ATP synthase.
Because we didn't draw that in.
Yeah, because it goes in. Have you guys seen a video of how ATP synthase works? Check it out on YouTube. It's really cool.
It's a turbine.
You know what it reminds me of?
For sure.
Like a mill?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's a rotary turbine.
Yeah.
Sure. And the thing that I think is really cool about that is it ties in why the proton gradient is cool. If you actually take away all the protein gradient from the outside and put it on the inside, it'll work in reverse and it'll burn ATP and put protons the other way. But if you put them on this side, it'll work that way and make ATP.
Yeah.
So it kind of, you just see it's just a machine.
Yeah.
And so that's why you need all the protons here, so it's making it.
I think humans are ingenious for producing something in real life that mimics what happens in our bodies to make energy without knowing that before. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
The patterns are pretty cool. Patterns are cool.
You see connection, Len? I'm like, are there just one? Like in each mitochondria?
Within this membrane, there's multiple ones of these. There's a whole lot of coenzyme Q in that membrane.
Yeah.
Multiple ones.
Okay. That's just never really been disgusting.
Because when people draw it, they only try to draw it once. Yeah.
Right.
So that line that you drew is the proton gradient?
The gradient is the situation where there's more of these out here than here. It's that situation of unequalness. That's the best definition I've ever come up with, I feel, for what a gradient really is. And students often do need that, so don't feel embarrassed. They need to know what a gradient is.
It's not like an actual, like...
No, it's a situation of unequalness.
Oh.
It's not something you can go, here's a gradient.
Oh.
See, gradient looks, no, it's a situation of unequalness.
Okay. I always pictured it like...
A river.
So when do the hydrogens, go through the gradient?
Everywhere.
At what point in the transport chain do the hydrogens flow through through ATP synthase?
That's what it
wants. I'm not sure I know what you're asking.
It builds up this.
What ATP synthase responds to is the relative amount of these two things. And if the ADP is accumulating as the cell runs out of ATP, that would make ATP synthase speed up. And so the gradient would be used more at that point.
So,
and then when the gradient starts being used more, the electron transport chain speeds up to maintain the gradient, to try to keep maintaining it. So it sort of starts here, and then everything that needs to speed up to support that speeds up in turn.
Here's the video that I remember seeing as far as the electron transport chain is that the electrons are flowing through and the gradient's being created, and then when the electron gets kind of to the oxygen, that's when the hydrogens start flowing through.
They go in between
that. It's all happening sort of at the same time.
Okay.
Where maybe the hydrogens coming through here right now are hydrogens that have been sitting out in the intramembrane space for a while.
I'm still confused about that. I don't understand what the hydrogens are doing still for the ATP synthase.
If you've got a dam and a water is not at the same level on both sides,
there's
a situation of unequalness.
Right.
How would you get energy out of that situation?
Release the water.
Just through the gates.
Open the gates and let it go.
Yeah.
And now you can't get any more energy out.
It's a potential.
But that's how you get energy out of a gradient, is you let it
relax. Right, so that makes sense. But in their actual chemical reaction, is there hydrogens or... I don't know why it just sounds...
Yeah, you should watch the
video.
Maybe
I'm looking too much into it, or... I understand there's no hydrogen gradient.
Maybe you are.
I should.
Because around now, people start to wonder too much, maybe, where these protons came from. And it's like, well, we can't really keep
track of them. They're all floating.
They were floating around in here, and we move around to here, so now they're just around out here.
Well, see, that makes sense. I think more maybe comparing it to other reactions we've had in class with enzymes, that those didn't need a proton gradient. So why does ATP synthase need a proton gradient? Or did they, and then I just wasn't aware of that? Or, I mean, do all enzymes need this gradient? And why does ATP synthase need it?
It's just structure.
The peptidase that works in our stomach, how it needs a high pH to be active. This, some enzyme has certain criteria that drive them.
Or like the calcium ion gated, the calcium channels.
That's better because it's a gradient.
Yeah. The calcium channels, you need those to initiate the myosin actin, right? Contraction.